Gelände bewahre, the Helleberg Transit Camp.
For the wasteland. It is unused land, a place of open possibilities, a platform for ideas and spontaneous occupation of space. It is an empty page, plain honesty in changing conditions. The wasteland stands for things that are not organized or monitored. Here the absence of rules and a pleasant standstill prevail. Here there is no gender, no work, no oppressive conditions. Each wasteland is a challenge, an inspiration, and offers the possibility of varied and brief views without the need to commit. The place sets no time frames, no capitalist standards of speed. The wasteland appears to be without the past and implies permanent revolution. The wasteland is a utopian place. Against the wasteland. It represents the absence of rules in a negative sense, one that doesn't contribute towards creating a utopia, but which is a negation of civilizing factors. It produces places of dread and creates associations with crime. It is located outside social structures, ignorant, and a space with the potential to be put to capitalist use. The wasteland provokes the urban planning question about the possible functional use. It masks its history and its future. It is a display of thoughtlessness. It makes itself the accomplice of all those who suppress, forget, or deny history. It stays silent. The wasteland is a place without utopia. In November 1942, the kindergarten was sent by Zeiss Ikon to an external labor assignment at the Helleberg on the outskirts of Dresden. Inside the barracks there, wooden bunks were stacked one above the other. We were made to stuff sacks with straw and sew them up for bedding. It was obvious that a camp was being set up, but we had no idea for whom. Perhaps, we thought, for French prisoners of war. Only weeks later, when all the Jews, except those living in mixed marriages, were being driven out of the Judenhäuser, did we realize that it was meant for our own people. Henny Brenner, das Lied ist aus.
Representatives of Zeiss Ikon AG, the Gestapo, and local NSDAP leaders met on November 10, 1942, to plan the establishment of a barrack camp at Dresden-Hellerberg. The plan was to deport Dresden's remaining Jews there, as well as those forced to work at Zeiss Ikon's Gödelwerk. After it turned out to be impossible to obtain barracks or materials to build a new camp, Zeiss Ikon had made available its own company materials store at Dr. Tote Strasse, today's Radeburger Strasse, just outside the city limits. The individuals responsible were the following. For the management of Zeiss Ikon, Dr. Johannes Hastenteufel, the works manager of the Gödelwerk on Grossenhainer Strasse, Wilhelm Stoffers, his deputy Karl Nitsche, the head of the optics department Friedrich Hempel, as well as Werner Ries, as correspondent. For the Gestapo, Kommissar Henry Schmidt, Obersekretär Rudolf Müller, and for the local NSDAP leadership, Mr. Köhler. The record of the meeting shows that the plan was for Zeiss Ikon to provide furnishings such as bedsteads and cupboards, whilst the Jews themselves would be obliged to bring a quota of household goods to equip the camp and furnish both the sick room and the offices. In addition, they were required to pay rent to Zeiss Ikon of 60 Reichspfennigs per head and day, initially for the first 2 months. They were to be billed for the food supplied to the camp at the end of each month. The record ends by setting out the date for the so-called moving in to the camp, November 23, 1942.
Most of my colleagues, too, were now living in the camp and marched to Zeiss Ikon each day, among them my aunt and uncle de Rauchs. All of them there were waiting to be deported. The Hellerberg was a kind of staging post for the 300 Jews who were deported to Auschwitz in March 1943. When the Hellerberg camp was emptied, the only Jews left behind in Dresden were those living in mixed marriages and their children. Henny Brenner, Das Lied ist aus. Whenever somebody was ordered to go to the Gestapo, a friend or relative always waited nearby to take him home after receiving the summons. Sometimes we collected dead bodies there too. That all came to an end when we were all forced out of our homes and sent to the barrack camp at Hellerberg. We got on very well with one another in the camp. There were few illnesses and only one death in the entire time. There was a tailor's shop, a shoemaker's, and a hairdresser. I wish they had let us stay there to the end of the war. They would all be still alive. Henry Meyer, Am Beispiel Dresdens. It is quite deplorable that this imprisonment is already considered to be halfway good fortune. It is not Poland, it is not a concentration camp, one does not quite eat one's fill, but one does not starve. One has not yet been beaten, etc., etc. Victor Klemperer, Diaries 1933-1945.
As quoted in the record, it was certain from the start that all of the people concentrated in this camp were to be deported. The point of this institution was clear to everyone involved in the planning. The local party leadership pursued the expulsion of the Jewish population from their homes, as well as their isolation from the so-called Aryan population. Once the camp had been established, they could then describe Dresden as being practically Jew-free. For the Gestapo, the planned centralized accommodation of the Jews opened up optimal conditions for surveillance. The concern itself was glad to have workers available so close by. On November 23, 1942, the 279 persons concerned had to attend the Municipal Decontamination Institute at Fabrikstrasse 6, where they were made to undergo a degrading disinfection procedure during which they were filmed. The following transfer to the camp at Hellerberg dragged on until November 24th. The camp was located in a sandpit and consisted of one communal hut and six accommodation barracks, each with three rooms for 16 people. Married couples were placed together, single women, men, and children older than four were separated according to gender. The guards for the camp were supplied by a Dresden security firm. There were fixed times for going out and staying in, which meant that for urgent visits to the doctor or to deal with official matters, one needed to get a pass from the camp authorities. During the hours of forced labor, however, it was necessary to leave the camp regularly and walk for 20 minutes to reach the factory buildings of the Gülewerk.
I only know that we got additional food from a former maid who lived in our home, not as a maid. She was part of the family. And this brave woman brought us things in the middle of the night which she had purchased or got someplace. She would take the last tram to the terminus, enter a forest and remain there until it was about 2 a.m., when she would meet me at these fences. In the camp, they weren't electrified, and hand all the stuff through to me. Then stay in the forest until breakfast or the break of day, when she would take the first tram back. Henry Meyer.
This is typical of Dresden here. You can't see anything at all anymore. Here you can see that this city has exhausted its entire potential for memory in the reconstruction of the Frauenkirche and that it does not care about a place like this.
What is one meant to see here then?
Well, either the remains of the camp or at least some kind of monument, a plaque, a stone, a sculpture, anything. Instead, all there is a wasteland. Everything has grown over, and if it wasn't for the poster in the passenger shelter down there, it would never occur to you that this was once the Hellerberg transit camp.
Sure, the signs and the documentation help us to understand. But the concentration camp as a memorial site? Landscape, seascape. There should be a word like timescape to indicate the nature of a place in time, that is, at a certain time, neither before nor after. Ruth Klüger, still alive, a Holocaust girlhood remembered.
Clearly, there's nothing here that shows a certain attitude on the part of the city. This inhospitable spot, directly on the road with heavy traffic and full of advertising. Whatever else it is not a place of commemoration. But on the other hand, its very lack of architecture allows it to escape the constraints of the usual forms of remembering.
What do you mean by that? Isn't it important that the authentic sites of persecution and annihilation should be indicated as such and made accessible to the public?
Well, quite apart from the fact that there aren't any sites of persecution and annihilation identified as such, precisely because persecution and annihilation took place everywhere. I don't mean that it isn't necessary to identify and thematize the location. However, I am skeptical because memorial sites also influence the thought processes of the visitors.
Huh? What?
Well, the memorial sites do not, in fact, escape the logic of the perpetrator. So anyone actually standing in such a memorial site simply cannot really extend their thinking beyond the underlying principle.
But if you didn't maintain the Nazi sites, that would open the floodgates for Holocaust deniers, wouldn't it?
Sure. I am not arguing that you should let grass grow over the matter, quite literally. However, I have a beautiful example of the limits of concentration camp memorial sites. Recently, I took part in a tour through the Auschwitz memorial sites, together with other historians. And one of the participants was carried away by the architecture of the camp and came up with a suggestion of a more effective solution for the design of the access routes to the gas chambers. I mean, she did not question the project of extermination itself. But what she found inhuman was the idea of presenting the gas chamber to the doomed people before their death by making them approach the entrance to the gas chambers frontally. She proposed a curve, which would hide the upcoming horrors from the waiting people until just before they went in. It wasn't even quite clear whether what she wanted was to protect the victims of extermination from panic, or whether she simply wished to simplify the job of the SS staff. Imagine, over 60 years later, someone submitting to the rationale of extermination. That's what I meant by saying that you cannot really think beyond the confines of the camp, that it is no longer about the anti-Semitism and the ideology of the elimination, which makes concentration camps possible in the first place.
Oh, right. I can see that. But that doesn't definitely rule out the possibility of a memorial to the memory of the fate of the Jews imprisoned here. You could at least erect a stone on which people could read the history, which would name the victims and act as a reminder to the following generations. After all, a memorial stone is something which survives the generation of the survivors.
The place which I saw, smelled, and feared, and which now has been turned into a museum, has nothing to do with the woman I am. Ruth Klüger, still alive, a Holocaust girlhood remembered. We walked into the main building, the museum, which used to be, a sign explained, the hospital where experiments on human beings were conducted. But aside from the note, everything was well presented, correctly, soberly, and intelligently. Those fucking Germans really pulled it off, I said to Markovsky. A nice mixture of decorum and hygiene, a perfect sense of the tragic, but without the horror, just as it should be, and yet... Raymond Federman, The Twofold Vibration.
Memorials always have a didactic function. In addition, they are confirmations of a community's identity and bear quite clear messages. However, they are not suitable to convey personal memories because they seek to replace discourse by material. Art has already come up with interesting approaches to this issue. There, it is not just a matter of remembering the past, but including the present in the debate. Remember, if you would, the suggestion of Horst Hoheisel made for the memorial to the murdered Jews of Europe in Berlin. It was called Blow Up the Brandenburg Gate and suggested demolishing the Brandenburg Gate. It was to be destroyed and ground to dust, and the area then sealed.
Well, one thing is clear. That would have produced an outcry throughout Germany. The indignation at the destruction of a national symbol.
Yes, yes, but which arguments would people have clung to when that was placed in the context of the millions of murdered people? There was hardly any outcry or resistance to the murder of millions at the time. The destruction of the Brandenburg Gate would probably bring about citizens' action groups, candlelit demonstrations and hunger strikes.
But there isn't even a debate or a suggestion for the Hellerberg. The only thing which fulfills a memorial function here at the moment is the film Die Juden sind weg, The Jews Are Gone, by Ernst Hirsch, telling the history of the camp. And that's more up to date, isn't it? It isn't bound to place or time, and the survivors are given a voice and even speak about anti-Semitism in Germany today.
When I was being made to stuff sacks with straw in Hellerberg camp back in 1942, I never dreamt that half a century later I would see the images of that place again. I received a call from Dresden in the middle of the 90s. Someone had found a documentary film about the Hellerberg camp and the prisoners interned there. A former laboratory technician or photographer of the Gulewerk had been ordered by the management to make a film at the time. When the Red Army invaded, he took the film home. 50 years later, he gave it to a well-known Dresden documentary filmmaker. He spent many hours of painstaking work restoring the heavily damaged film so that it could be screened. He couldn't identify the people in the film, though. He invited me to Dresden so that I could view the film and contribute to the preparations of the upcoming documentation. I was tremendously excited as I saw my former friends again, with whom I had worked in the kindergarten at Zeiss Ikon and who had all been killed in Auschwitz. Henny Brenner, das Lied ist aus.
At the moment, the film is one of the few documents in existence, and thus also a kind of monument. Yet there are a number of problems here too. The original film material, the documentation of the move to Hellerberg, was filmed by Erich Höhne, who was an employee of Zeiss Icon. It is still unclear on whose orders or for which purpose. Nor do we know whether the material was shown in public at the time. However, the motifs which were chosen, and the cut, especially the titlings, they all evidently display anti-Semitic motives. Thus the Jews who are shown are at least in part portrayed from a National Socialist perspective. They're all shown in situations which were not of their own choosing, and the camera is not on their side. For example, the degrading sequences showing people in the Decontamination Institute. It is at this point, at the latest, that the camera becomes a weapon.
But if one shows these images to Dresdeners today, for example, it is to be hoped that it would demonstrate clearly to them the connection between the history of the city and the Shoah. So, is it permissible to show this material or not?
I don't know either. But if you don't point out that the audience is seeing matters from the perspective of the perpetrator, you run the risk of making the people depicted into objects again.
Ah, that's true. In other words, it is essential to mention who took the pictures and when, on whose orders, for which purpose, and under which circumstances they came about, how the images were cut together, and what the relationship is between the camera and the people depicted.
What amazes me, Hank was saying, is how carefully they kept records of all that. Those pictures, after all, were taken by the people who ran the camps. What strange need that they have to want to preserve a visual record of those atrocities doesn't make sense to me. It's a basic human need, I said, a need to keep track of what man supposedly does to perfect history. I'm sure they were convinced that they were doing was for the good of humanity. They were cleaning up the world of all that filth, that vermin. Raymond Federman, The Twofold Vibration.
The so-called factory action, which was intended to end all employment of Jews in the armaments industry throughout Germany so that they could then be deported, marked the end of the Hellerberg transit camp in Dresden. On February 27, 1943, everyone interned there was arrested before beginning their regular morning journey to work, and the camp was declared a police prison. In the period up to March 2nd, even more Jews were transferred there from Erfurt, Halle, Leipzig, Plauen, and Chemnitz. In the evening of the same day, the evacuation of the camp began, which meant that all the prisoners were driven by truck to the Dresden-Neustadt goods station. In the early hours of March 3, 1943, the transport left the station, taking the people to the extermination camp at Auschwitz-Birkenau.
Email correspondence with Roni Pallet from Israel. March 1st, 2008. Hello, sir. Hello, lady. I just found by internet some information about Hellerberg camp and some pictures shown there. On picture number 7, on right of the picture, there's a man with a bag in his hand and a hat on his head. So, this is our grandfather, Simon Silbermann. He and his wife Gertrud, Nie Fleischmann, were sent with the last Jewish from Dresden to the lager of Hellerberg, and then to Auschwitz for their death. My father and his twin brother, Harry and Siegbert Silbermann, left and went to Israel in 1935. Unfortunately, my father passed away, but his brother, who is my uncle, recognized his father in this picture. We would like to ask you if it is possible, please, to receive a copy from this film. What I have found is much more than just a photo of my grandfather. This is one frame from a movie. This means there's a movie showing our grandfather walking, in motion. This is just one picture from the movie. For us, that will be the last picture from him, last memory. Simon and his wife Gertrud, and Simon's brother, Labus, and his wife, Rosa, and their daughter, Margot Felicia Silbermann. The entire Silbermann family were killed in Auschwitz, March 2nd to 3rd, 1943, immediately upon arrival at the selection platform. We will thank you very much for any advice. Perhaps you can help me to find a copy or contact to Ulrich Teschner or Ernst Hirsch. With best regards, Roni Pellet, Israel. April 6th, 2008. Dear Katrin, Hirsch sent me the film of Lager Hellerberg. I want to thank you about everything you did for me. Best and Pesach Semeach. Roni Pellet, Israel. July 29th, 2008. Dear Katrin, I think it is okay for me if you use my emails for your guide. I have no problem with that. Do you need more materials? If yes, don't hesitate to ask. I must say that the film strip was so touching for our hearts and gave rise to shiver, sorrowful of thoughts. My teenage daughter asks me to look at the film strip again and again and again. The eyes see, and the heart hesitates to understand. Best wishes, Roni.